Very fine LP on the Blackest Rainbow label. It's called Vestiges of an Inherent Melancholy. And I do believe the track we're listening to right now is called All You See Is Red, But All You Feel Is Blue. We ended that set with Solvent, 2004, I believe, release called Apples and Synthesizers, from which we heard a track entitled Radar Receiver. The great Belgian duo Benny Jesseret before that, with a new collection of unreleased stuff. It's called Half Unreleased Madness. From that, a track called Orchestral Story. Before that, it was one of these weird sort of like K-Tel type no-name band covers of otherwise well-known techno songs, which is a whole lot of what you find if you spend too much time on Spotify. It's called Spectacular Synthesizer Collection, and we heard someone known as The Synthesizer doing Maid of Orleans. Before that, the recently late great Konrad Schnitzler, with a new release with Borngräber and Struver. It's called Construct, and we heard Construct 7. We heard a great track from the new Big Blood LP. It's called Big Blood and the Wicked Hex. The track was called Water. And we open this set with a great West Coast pop art experimental band cover from Neo Maya, doing up I Won't Hurt You. Thank you for listening. Thanks to my very excellent guests, Angels in America, for a really great set. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed our ridiculous interview. Thank you to Ivan Shimchak for shooting the set on video. And there's a link. You can go check it out yourself. It's posted on Vimeo. And she took the picture that adorns the playlist today as well. You are tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide on the internet, WFMU.org. My name is Scott. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is coming right up.
When I first learned that the British humorist Chris Morris was filming a comedy about a cell of idiotic suicide bombers who try to blow up the London Marathon, I remember having two reactions. The first was, wow. And the second was, this will definitely never come out in America. But I was wrong. About a month ago, the Alamo Drafthouse Theater chain in Austin announced it was going into the film distribution business and that Chris Morris's comedy, Four Lions, would be their maiden voyage. Now, what was especially weird about this turn of events was the announcement that Chris would be doing press for the film. You see, he's never really done this before. Throughout his career, he's made it a point to totally avoid the media. Now, you might not be familiar with Chris Morris, but that's okay. He is foreign. But in the late 90s, he, Armando Iannucci, and Steve Coogan created a fake news show. The radio version was called On the Hour, and then for television, it was called The Day Today.
The Day Today, because fact into doubt won't go.
Morris then went on to create Brass Eye, the meanest fake news show ever made. Celebrities and politicians were fooled into going on camera and attacking made-up things like a dangerous new drug called cake and video games pedophiles play with children.
An online pedophile has converted that eye to work as a webcam.
He also created the radio show Blue Jam, a comedy that had more of a David Lynch dreamlike feel to it. This also was adapted for television. Jam.
In Jam.
His last big project was the TV series Nathan Barley. This took on the whole new media industry, a brutal, cruel satire. And while you can find all of this work on DVD or YouTube, you won't find any interviews he did with the press. So you can imagine how strange it was for all of us fans to see him doing this media barrage for Four Lions. He did NPR, Opie and Anthony, blogs, podcasts. It turns out that even I was able to get in on the game. And so, the other day, Bill Bowen and myself set up a studio in the restaurant of his hotel, and Chris Morris and I just started talking. Let's talk about this cast. You have a jihadi cell comprised of five guys living in Sheffield. Now, you've been traveling around the U.S. a little bit for the movie. Have you found a city yet that would be sort of like the American equivalent of Sheffield?
In the film, it's sort of Sheffield because we shot it there, but it's only sort of Sheffield because we tried. I mean, there are certain, obviously, if you know Sheffield, there are landmarks there, and indeed, there'll probably be a plaque now, a blue sort of plaque on the kebab shop that we blew up. The rest of that kebab shop company changed its livery a couple of months after we completed the film, but that one stayed in those colours because those are the colours that are used in the film. You know, so it's a badge of honour to have been blown up by Wadge. But anywhere here, no. I mean, you know, it's a totally different dynamic. Why don't you suggest
I was thinking like somewhere like Pittsburgh or Ohio, some sort of like city that's moved on.
Keep going. There are lots though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've just got weeds growing through the pavement. I mean, actually that's a slur on Sheffield. and, you know, you will have to be held to account for that. But no, I mean, atmospherically, you know, the great thing about Sheffield was really the thing that clinched it early on was that I knew that there would be a scene where somebody in escaping from a scene in a city was very soon going to be running through a field in which they would trip and detonate a sheep. and when you go to Sheffield, because it's built on hills, it means that you have these kind of fingers of land extending into the city space. Mm. And you do indeed have fields very close to the city centre. And that really was about the biggest single swinging point for me. I thought, we are going to film here. I mean, Warp are based there. There are great, you know, there are other great things about it, but that is a detail that really helps.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the field with the sheep, but it seems that you not only assemble a diverse range of Muslim types, but it's sort of a diverse range of guys who would imagine are trying to escape, maybe, or not fitting in a place like Sheffield. I mean, it seems like what unites them all is this: they don't fit in, they all want to be a part of something bigger, or they're frustrated.
But we all know that feeling at some point, right? That you
yeah.
want to be, you know, I mean, alienation, and it's not quite true to say. Some people come across and say, these guys, they're just sort of punks by another name, aren't they? They're just sort of punks who've accidentally got involved in, you know, blowing things up. It's not quite as simple as that. But alienation does have a part to play, I think. And also, to be caught up in a big story when you're leading a small life is a pretty intoxicating idea. I mean, I spoke to a guy who fought for the Taliban against the Northern Alliance in the 90s. And he explained exactly that feeling of, you come across a farm that's been decimated by the Northern Alliance. And so we're talking about people who are pretty vicious. There's a guy called General Dostum who has a pretty, pretty impressive track record of atrocity. You come across people lying all over the place, guts hanging out. You come across the only person left alive is a grandmother sitting on a chair. She's lost her whole family, and she slaps you in the face because you didn't turn up soon enough to deal with these guys. He says, You cannot but be fighting on the right side if you're fighting against that. And if you're young and you feel that God's on your side as well, it's not going to get any better than that. It's like sort of, it's the best version of Band of Brothers you could think of. Right, so he was talking about the past there. He has perspective on it now. But that description of that feeling, that sort of, it's a, you know, a romantic, you might say dangerously romantic idea. But that is an understandable call to me.
Yeah. Now, two of the members... And a lot of the humor that revolves around these two guys, Waj and Fessel, I mean, they seem kind of borderline mental.
Foolish behavior is not always the province of the brain damage. Though I agree with you that I wouldn't set Waj in to go and win an argument for me anywhere.
No, no. Here's a clip of Fessel explaining to Barry how he got a stash of peroxide together. Let's listen to that.
Liquid peroxide.
3 years of stockpiling.
How'd you get it all?
A wholesale shop down the road.
What, all from the same shop?
Yeah.
You mug, you'll get us nicked.
No. I use different voices every time I go in.
Different what? Different voices?
Different voices.
Show me.
What?
Show me the voices, come on.
Can I have 12 bottles of bleach, please?
What's that?
It's a woman's voice, because I've got got loads of liquid peroxide, and she probably thought that you'd go in there and...
And what?
Dye her hair or something.
And a beard.
What?
You got a beard.
I covered it.
You covered your beard?
Yeah.
So you went into a shop with your hands on your face like that and asked for 12 bottles of bleach. So why has she got her hands on her face, Fe?
Because she's got a beard.
Yeah, now I'd say that's because he's nervous.
Not because he's mental.
I don't... Well, hey, come on. How can you use a word like mental when I've used a caring word like retarded just a second ago? I'd say he... I mean, look, he's clever enough to have done something. It's just that he's not got grade A. And I think he is made nervous in that film. I'm not, you know, I'm speaking on his behalf now. But in that scene, he is made nervous. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he's not, you'd say he's not really full of initiative in keeping himself unknown.
No. But Waj, the other character, he can't tell chickens from rabbits.
Come on. You want some?
Yeah, you want some rabbit, eh? No, some rabbit with no ears, eh?
The chickens.
I roast you.
What's the chickens?
Listen, I worked with a guy who was intelligent, but we were on a farm and we were actually talking to some dog handlers and we realised he was staring in open-mouthed horror at something in a field. And we said, what's wrong? And he said, what is that? And we said, it's a donkey. And he said, what's a donkey? Now, this is a guy who basically had been through the whole British education system, and I don't mean that as a slur on the British education system, and was a functionally intelligent man, but he didn't know what a donkey was. Mm. He wondered if it was a kind of dog. So it's not just an indication of Wadge's... I mean, look, he just could be ignorant rather than unintelligent.
Okay, okay.
We're going to have to go through the film, and I'm going to have to make a case at, like, some sort of educational tribunal.
Yes, well, we do. The other two characters, Omar and Barry, are kind of vying for the leadership role. And let's talk about Barry first. He's obviously a convert, but this story is never really discussed, which makes it even kind of more funny. But what is his story?
There was... a neo-Nazi ideologue who, I think he's still alive actually, who caused, who was the sort of godfather of a group called Combat 18 in Britain. It's a far-right group. Have you heard of Combat 18? Can you guess why they would be called Combat 18?
No.
Well, it's to do in the 18 are the first and eighth letters of the alphabet. And that gives you that gives it's not very deep, and I'm not saying this to be clever, but that gives you A.H. and Adolf Hitler, and that's why they were called Combat 18, and that was their ideology, was essentially rediscovering the National Socialism. And when he saw 9/11, he thought, these guys have got the best game on the planet. I'm converting to Islam, which he duly did. So that's not quite Barry's story, but it's an example of somebody starting off with an extreme ideology which has a destructive and apocalyptic bent, finding in this version of it the best means of expressing themselves. So we saw Barry as a nihilist. I mean, I think there was a scene where he was going to reveal, he was going to be bare-chested, if you can imagine. He was going to reveal that he had sort of far-right tattoos on, and there'd be a sense of the past. But, you know, I know a guy who worked in an Islamic bookshop, and a Hell's Angel came in, and he thought he was going to have to defend the bookshop against his Hell's Angel. He looked pretty fierce. And he said, I want to convert to your religion. Can you tell me? And they duly did, and they filled him in. And a month later, he took his shahada and he became a Muslim. And then he disappeared for 3 months. And then when they next saw him in the bookshop, he was saying, come on, let's bring on the end of the world. It's all going to come down. Let's all go up in a big ball of flames. And you have sort of enough examples that are a bit Barry-ish that when we played the film, people said, I know a Barry.
Definitely. Here in America, absolutely.
There's loads of them.
Oh, yeah. No.
His
ignorance is goes beyond funny. His ignorance is actually scary. I mean, if there's really a demonic character in the film, it would certainly be him.
Well, yes, I think he's the only one who would happily espouse evil. I think the others think they're doing the right thing at some level, but he doesn't care about whether he's doing the right thing.
He's also the only character we see actively recruiting someone. He finds a young Muslim jihadist rapper, Hassan, and he convinces him it's time to step it up.
Yo, you're a ledge. You're a ledge,
bro. Not so bad yourself, brother.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Hassan Malik. The Mal.
The Mal?
Yeah.
Nice little stump back there.
Yeah.
And you know what?
Yeah.
You're a total piece of shit, mate. You're worse than the specially trained rapists they use in Guantanamo.
You are?
Yeah, you're not ignorant like them. You know you should be doing something.
Well, I am doing something.
Oh, what that? I'm the Mujahideen and a thingy-thingy rep. Huh?
It was jihad of the mind. The gesture that messed you.
Was the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, about gestures? Did he smash the pagan statues, or did he just stand there making a gesture? Is this a gesture? That was for real, brother.
Did you find anyone like, you know, sort of moments like this is something that actually is a concern of society. The how does the radicalization happen? And this is really a moment for, you know, that you provide for us.
Yeah, it's atypical though, that one. And I think it's faulty, and it seemed to be faulty throughout the film. It's not really tied down. I think a better route is to consider yourself to be a charitable person. I don't know who's the most charitable person you could think of. Who's iconically charitable in this country? You know, we did have people like Princess Diana, Bob Geldof, obviously in the old days. But who is the most iconically charitable? Somebody who would appear on television and show you something terrible that was happening somewhere in the world. I mean, look, we all know Bono, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the Bono call. It's the look at these suffering people. What can you do about it?
Yeah, yeah.
Is there anyone better than Bono?
You know, for a while it seemed like John Edwards' wife was trying to go.
I'd like to drag in John Edwards' wife as an agent of radicalism right now. So let's do that, okay? It's a model, it's a thought experiment, but basically somebody who appeals to your better nature and then says, what are you going to do about it? And you say, I don't know. And it's a reasonable thing to ask, right? Yeah. Normally it's put your hand in your pocket and shell out and give a bit of money. What if it's go over and help, go over and do some medical aid? What if it's then when you're over there, you better learn to defend yourself? Can you use a gun? No, or we'll train you to use a gun. I'm making it very easy now, but it's something a bit like that happens, certainly in the case of the previous wars, where, for example, Margaret Thatcher was saying to Muslims, you should go over and fight in Bosnia against the Serbs. Now, that was a sort of jihad. Okay, so these kind of steps are going to give you a better chance at persuading somebody to get involved in this stuff than the version that Barry comes up with. But the version that Barry comes up with we felt was comically justified, and also because it doesn't really work.
No.
that's also a good reason for it to be in the film.
Yeah. Omar, the star of the film and really the cell's leader, he's the one who seems to be more than one-dimensional. He's got a fundamentalist...
How dare you? The rest are one-dimensional? Oh!
No.
I have to sit here and take this.
Come on. Omar is the one that seems to be carrying the water. He's got this fundamentalist brother, this seemingly liberated wife, an inquisitive kid, but yet he's the one who really wants to make this strike for jihad. And he never communicates why exactly. I get the sense that, you know, he himself doesn't really know. It's like he's got this fuzzy rage, which is understandable in the real world, but this sort of thing doesn't seem to work so well at the movies. You know, characters like Omar are supposed to have something concrete driving them, something like an innocent friend who was gunned down by the police or a horrible affront by Western civilization.
Well, do you think that's how we work?
No, I said in the real world,
yeah,
these
things
work.
You know, let's be fair. There are singly motivated revenge missions which do happen in real life, but I don't think these tend to be that. You know, the thing I was saying a moment ago about the charitable call to arms is part of it. And what we wanted to do in the film was to make sure that Omar's motivation was there, but it wasn't there as a single inciting incident, because that would be artificial. You could have... I mean, I've seen productions which take the radicalization of somebody as... in that mode, and what you end up with, therefore, if it's for a sort of understandably single good reason, they look like the militant wing of Amnesty International. But that's not really how it works. But it contains that. Omar chides his brother for not getting involved, for being too rule-bound to really see the bigger picture, and Omar's just taking the shortcut to get out there and defend Muslims who are being attacked. He refers to the fact that he lost a cousin in Bosnia. He... also, when he's telling Waj, he's talking about heaven. He's talking about how short your life on earth is here. You know, that's partly, that's like Joyce or something. I mean, that's recognizable not just in Islam, but certainly in Catholicism. You get a very strong sense of the afterlife and how bad it might be to go to hell.
Yeah. And having a shortcut to the top floor.
Yeah, listen, you get a free pass. And that's the key thing. It's not this, you know, it's not that the virgins aren't mentioned, but the key thing is a free pass to heaven. And I think that's a pretty good way. Look, to get to the point where you're actually going to lose your life, definitely, you have to have some sort of, either you have to have somebody, you have to be at gunpoint, right? Some of the kamikaze pilots, I think, were that equivalent, but also others and other people who've given their lives in a cause. You have to have a sort of a kind of transcendent ideology of some kind, a belief that will catapult you that way. And that's there too, albeit expressed as rubber dinghy rapids, because he's talking to Waj. But we know that's part of Omar's mind as well. So it's all of the assembly is there. I mean, the thing is that when you read into this, you can't come up with single, simple kind of catapult moves. It is, and I think don't you find that you end up in situations by a series of weird small steps? And quite often you find yourself doing things, and if somebody says, why are you doing this, you can't really account for it in a simple way, but you know damn well you're doing it.
But that's the thing, that's what people really want the answer to right now. They want to know why these people are being motivated to do something like
that. But I think decrease the size of the question, because we all understand stories, heroic stories, where people give their lives. Now, it's not saying I'm not making the old moral equivalence argument. I'm just looking at a mechanism. And I don't think it's that unfathomable. It's not as unfathomable. I think people are trying to answer too big a question. But the real question is not to do, I think, with that in itself, because I think if you talk to people who are involved in fighting in any degree, a lot of what they have to do is way beyond the reach and experience of normal people. You know, soldiers have to do things that you would never dream to do, and you'd never want to get anywhere near doing, you know, and people don't really credit soldiers for that, and they go through hell as a result of it. But the fact is that the reason that we don't find that totally mind-blowing is because they're sort of on the right side, and we protect ourselves in the way we think about it. And I think it's if you're on the wrong side, so to speak, that's what helps build this thing into something that's so big. But you know, I mean, we have films where people give up their lives. You know, the heroes are the ones who went first. And I think these guys see themselves, at least some of them see themselves as heroes if they are in control of what they're doing.
One of the things that really struck me about the world of Four Lions is that all the wires also seem sort of fuzzy and crossed when it comes to Islam. You know, Omar, our wannabe jihadist, works as a mall security guy, but he dresses like a normal dude. Early on in the film, we meet his brother, who's dressed as the fundamentalist. He doesn't want to come into the house because he doesn't want to be in the same room as Omar's wife, who seems to be a modern woman, but yet she's, you know, cheering on her soon-to-be martyred husband. It seems impossible to suss out what is good Islam and what is bad Islam. And this is like something, you know, people are obsessed with doing when it comes to anything made about Islam.
So in your dream TV show, you'd say, we've got some Muslims in the studio today. On the right here, we've got some good Muslims. And over here, we've got some bad Muslims. You'll see that the bad Muslims have longer beards and they have a more frowny, thick eyebrowed look. And the good Muslims, they almost look like us, don't they? And some of these people even listen to music. Would you believe it? Because that's forbidden in the Quran. But they've managed to parley that. We like these people. Oh, look, and here are some Jews over here. And what are they? I don't know. They've got turbans as well, but I haven't got that far. My research doesn't extend that far. I mean, you know, the thing is that you nothing...
It sounds like your good AIDS, bad AIDS sketch from...
I wasn't going to say that, but I thought if I went on enough like that, you might get there. But basically, I think that you can't, you know, you come across contradictions. There aren't, I mean, even the word fundamentalist doesn't really have a clear meaning. And the truth is that people who get involved in sort of jihadi projects, shall we call them, for want of just coining another bad phrase, they don't, some of the ideology sounds very hard baked indeed. It was, you know, hard boiled. And I would say that it doesn't mean that the people that follow it are necessarily as strict as the call to arms might sound. And everything is not easily pigeonholed, you know, from there on in. I mean, Omar's brother is strict. He's, perhaps a better word would be orthodox. But it's a kind of orthodoxy. And one of the sort of things that you have to learn is that he can sound very similar to somebody who, like Ayman al-Zawahiri, who lays down all the rules and does exhort people to violence. This guy can sound similar, perhaps, in his attitudes to home life, how home life should be, but be entirely the opposite. Just believe that there's no way on earth you're allowed to kill people. And the same with, you know, Omar's wife doesn't have to be... you don't have to be sort of wearing a burqa to think that the right way to conduct this resistance movement... is to get, you know, to get violent. There was a case in Holland where some jihadis were in the dock and they were seeking to defend themselves by stepping back from the radical ideology which they had sort of espoused a few months previously. And one of their wives from the dock leaned over and said, "I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you," officially, because he was reneging on the deal. So, you know, you don't have a sort of... None of our perceptions are really quite right, and I think that what happens in the film is quite understandable, but it just doesn't fit the preset labels.
It doesn't, and I feel that here in America, at least, writers, filmmakers, humorists are almost expected. It's almost like they have a responsibility. They're told they have a responsibility to the audience to help them sort out that tricky, thorny question.
Well, look, if you can basically say, make something that people who know the subject say has both its feet on the ground, then the answers are out there. If you want to know about it, don't just expect the film to tell you everything.
Right. Well, welcome to America. But there
no,
is...
I mean, you know, it's funny to see any appraisal of the film, which, I mean, because there aren't many examples of engaging with this subject in culture, let alone popular culture. So if one does come along, some people do expect it to answer every single question they might have in their head so they can carry on as being as f***ing lazy as they were before they saw it.
Again, welcome to America.
Sorry, is this an FCC?
That's okay, I can beep it out. But all right, I'd like to just talk about where this project begins, because, you know, you take the war on terror on very early. You and Armando Iannucci do this thing in The Observer, I think March of 2002, I think it's the first major comedy piece I see on 9/11. This friend of mine sent me the scans, the atrocity insert, and it was called The 6 Months That Changed the Year. And there was this amazing line in there that still cracks me up. "Figures show that even as the second tower fell, people were switching off their televisions, complaining they'd seen it all before." And then after that, you do these George Bush cut-ups that were done before anyone else really started doing them. In fact, the Smoke Hammer thing we played on WFMU, it was a hit, actually. And it's in the same spirit, using the war on terror as fodder for comedy. But when do you turn your attention to the terrorists themselves?
There's so much interesting material. I mean, look, I was looking to enhance my understanding of the subject, because what you get in the media is a pathetic, thin, hard-baked version. And I was just not expecting to find funny incidents. But I did. And when I did, I thought, by the time this has become a pattern and it's surprising to me, then if I can make things which are funny surprising to other people, that's a pretty good way of making a piece of entertainment. So that's why. I mean, it was reality was saying this is much funnier than you think it would be by throwing up examples like guys who wanted to blow up a warship with an exploding boat, and they put their launch in the water, fill it with explosives, and it sinks. Yeah. And you think, okay, that's something that could be in a farce, but I wasn't expecting to read it about a bunch of terrorists. And whether they succeed or fail, you know, whether they're the 9/11 plotters teasing their ringleader, Mohammed Atta, for being so strict, they called him the Ayatollah, or teasing the fact that when he goes to the bathroom, his piss is extraordinarily loud, and when he comes back, he tries to say, it's nothing to do with me, I haven't got a very high-volume piss, it's because the doors are Jewish. And this kind of behaviour is basically recognisable as blokes sort of getting on in a group and getting on and not getting on, and the sort of petty arguments. You know, it's a small group in a box, and that's what you get when you're in a jihadi cell.
Yeah, but before you get to the jihadis, there's so much comedic material in, like, Tony Blair, George Bush, and sort of the Western response.
That's the first bit that you were talking about. Yeah, well, I mean, that was the language, particularly the media language. In a way, that was the thin description that caused me to look into this in greater depth, because we basically know nothing about this. And yet, we're you know, constantly exhorted to spend a lot of money on it and pay a lot of attention to it, and indeed duly be frightened.
Yeah. So I've read that you're a very meticulous researcher. So when you decided to focus on
this, right, you have to be. You can't just sort of make it up.
Yeah. So how did you get started in there? I mean, I would imagine a lot of documentary filmmakers, academic types, were calling up the imams, trying to learn more about it. But you had to be the only comedian.
Yeah, I didn't come across too many others. You get started how you can. You just make a load of contacts and you plunge into it pretty blind, and it focuses by degrees. You meet people who are maybe journalists who give you a pass you on a contact who works in the security services, or you go to mosques, you go to Islamic centres, you meet youth workers. And then by degrees, and this one it gets really interesting, you sort of meet people who are much more normal, who don't have official labels and titles, and you just get to hang out with them, and then you learn quite a lot more about how family dynamics are important, how brothers and sisters get on, stories about cousins. There's so much sort of movement. You know, British Pakistanis, the kind of age that we're dealing with in the film, have been around for, you know, they're probably second, third generation. So there's a lot of British culture mixed up with a lot of Pakistani culture. They have homes back in Kashmir or wherever it is. And it all gives you a very fascinating, I have to say great fun, and complicated picture of where these little niches of, you know, violent radicalism reside.
Yeah. I mean, you've written, or you've spoken a lot already about some of those moments, like the boat sinking, that sort of turned you onto the comedic
potential. How many
times?
I mean, count them, seriously. Yeah. You know, you could do an internet trawl and end up with just one species of fish, and that would be it. But such is the necessity.
What were some of the other things you learned about, like, sort of like family dynamics? That's how, you know, that early on when you started this research.
Well, things like, I mean, people often talk about the swearing in the film because, for all you know, that could be just for fun. But in actual fact, there was a court case where these guys in the dock were recorded for up nearly 6 months, just sitting around talking like stoners, really. They were a cell who'd got as far as getting 600 kilos of fertilizer in a lockup. And when they bought that fertilizer, the guy who sold it to them said, this is really for your allotment? Because this is enough for four football pitches. And they just said, yeah, well, we've got a pretty big allotment. And he said, you're not going to make it into a bomb, are you? And they went, no. And anyway, they duly went to Pakistan to learn how to make it into a bomb. And they came back, they sat around talking about it for a while, and then they forgot how to make it into a bomb. And then we recorded phoning back their contacts in Pakistan saying, yeah, listen, brother, that bomb you told us how to make, that recipe, could you just give that to us again? Which point the line would go dead. Now, that's, I just tell you that as a prelude to set up the calibre of these guys. But they were recorded, I mean, chapter and verse for months. And within that group, you just get a very strong clue as to the reality, the sort of the down-to-earth reality of this stuff. And one of the points they made was about their elders swearing. And they said, isn't it funny how your grandparents will just drop clangers the whole time? And I asked a few of my Pakistani friends about this. They said, oh, yeah, they're talking about swearing in Punjabi, which is an agricultural language where you can talk about, you know, hippos, vulvas and donkeys' arses and how they may or may not relate to your aunt and her body parts. And that's part of the just the language you can drop. You know, a guy told me that he was at a wedding and a little niece of his came up and said, offered him some food and said, do you want some of this? And that was like, or maybe in goat fish. But I mean, the thing was, it was, he said that as a Brit, he finds it shocking, but as a Pakistani, you don't. So that gave us the license to play with language. And that was the sort of thing that you could see, you know, people will swear when their parents aren't in the room because it's to be seen to be swearing in front of a guest by your parents is not the same as your grandparents dropping the F word whenever they want. You know, so all of the dynamics and the protocols of swearing, they give you something.
So a lot of this research seems to start before the London bombings in 2005.
Well, yeah, I had started then, yeah. But I mean, I suppose the London bombings they certainly bring a lot into focus because you get this very jarring sense of people who are recognisably and obviously British, English. A very, that accent that they have is an accent that you associate with a sort of, we associate with a homely bread advert from the 70s. You know, it's a kind of very, it's a sort of unassailably British accent, and therefore it's disconcerting to see this accent basically coming out of the mouths of terrorists, and you get the homegrown terrorist idea from that. And
yeah, but
what's your point?
I can't imagine for a second that the bombings made you think, I guess I need to put this idea on the shelf. But clearly you're aware that for commissioners and, you know, managers of studios, that the bombings may have changed everything for making a comedy about suicide bombers in set in London, no?
I don't care about them. I mean, you know, really, they can get on in their own sweet way. You're always going to be a struggle for one reason or another. So, you know, they can think what they like. I mean, you basically have to nick their money anyway, so you're not going to care what they think.
No, I guess I'm just saying, did the conversations change since you were already sort of on the path of making this? Well, did the bombings sort of...
I was making it in my head. I was at the maximum delusional stage. I mean, basically, to get involved in a thing like this, you do have to brainwash yourself against objective reality pretty severely. You think you're making a film, everyone else thinks you've just run out of ideas and are trying to cover it. So I wasn't at the stage of discussing it in terms of raising money when the London bombs came along. I was at the stage of assembling the kinds of ideas which represented a more accurate portrayal of how this stuff works.
So the film's opening up here in the States now, but it opened in the UK last May. And already this week, I found you got nominated for a lot of awards. The Best British Independent Film Debut Director Award, Best Screenplay, and then Waj and Omar also got nominated.
Where's Nigel Lindsay in that list?
Asher
Ali?
About the response, though. Was there an outrage when this film came out?
No. I mean, I have to be fully disappointing and say that although we'd been warned with people... we'd been warned by people with pure delight how much trouble this was going to cause. I'm glad to say that they were ignorant. And therefore, there wasn't any of that sort of expected noise because I think people can see that the film is it's not gratuitous. Mm. You know, it's reflecting something that happens. So actually, whether they were Muslims or whether they worked in the military or the police or, you know, whether they were considered themselves as perfectly average people who, you know, go to work every day like you and I, they saw what was common in human experience in the film.
Yeah, but so they there was saw nothing. It. I remember when the Peter
You mean
Geddon...
before they saw it?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Because
Let's talk about people who
well,
have
the,
opinions
remember
about
when the Peter Geddon special came out, the Brass Eye, there were some famous critics that went on television to talk about how much they were upset about the show without even having seen it.
Or politicians.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that happened again in, or has media criticism evolved?
Well, this is a whole new territory now, isn't it? Because didn't Zizek recently review Avatar without seeing it?
I had not known
and
that.
And apparently it was a spot-on review. I haven't read it, but it was written in a French film journal. And I think...
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it? That's
yeah.
quite impressive. Now, I'm imagining the best possible version of that, which
I
is that, that he's got all the detail right as well, which is perhaps because you could... I mean, Avatar is an assembly of presets with some pretty good special effects. But no, I think people will always, you know, on knee-jerk subjects, people will always comment, but we really didn't, have it this time because, I don't know, I think because people could probably tell early on that something different to what they thought might be going on was going on. I mean, look, you have a way of, this. You know, a TV program can go out on a Friday and there can be outrage on a Saturday and most people won't have seen it. But here, a film leaks out much more. You know, it gets shown at Sundance, and it gets shown at South by Southwest, and that's all before it's been shown at a festival, long before it's released in Britain. So there are many opportunities to go, I would look a bit foolish if I came out on
But
that.
You still had some pretty notable...
You want some people to be foolish on this film's case, don't you?
Well, no, I mean, you had some enemies. I mean, the paedophilia special angered, I think, of like the Daily Mail. I think they even sent photographers to harass your family, I believe. I mean, didn't they want to have another go at you?
To be perfectly honest, I wasn't paying much attention. But even when, you know, even when there's a howl of outrage from something like the Daily Mail... when you do a program that upsets them, it's virtual because you know people that work at the Daily Mail who say, I love the show. It's a shame I have to do this, but it works for the editor, but I love it. So the thing is complete nonsense. Yeah. And in fact, the Daily Mail did a great service for the Brass Eye special because when you've made a program like that, I mean, this will sound very arrogant, but I'll say it anyway. I can't be bothered not to. But when you've made a program like that, by the time you've got to the end of it, there's no mirth in it for you. You know, you've completed it. You've done, you've got to the end. It's a full stop. You'd be mad to sit down and laugh your way through it. But they... printed about half the program as a transcript in order to rile their readers and rev them up into how appalling this was. And I read it and thought, actually, you know, when all said and done, this is good stuff. Mm. You know, it was funny. It was funny on the page. Maybe they just did this for me. Maybe that was the writers who knew damn well they were being flat-out hypocritical, just saying, we'll offer him one of those. But, you know, the truth is that it is all a bit of a... It's all a bit of a fiction, really.
Hmm. Now, I told you I didn't expect the film to come out here in America. Did you feel the same? I mean, you talked about the film debuting at Sundance. Did you have conversations with some of the big independent distributors then?
I didn't. Well, I think I did have one, and I couldn't stand him, so I just told him he was an idiot. So that was the end. That was the last conversation I was allowed to have with anyone. But I think. Things were reasonably slow, but what was weird about this was that the conversation started at Sundance, but it just took a very long time to gestate. Mm. It was almost as if a word had to grow before it came out of somebody's mouth. That word was only yes, but it took a long time coming out. And that was because I think, you know, it was a sort of, like when we had funding, it was a film that would often divide a board or a committee. So that was the case with distributors. And in the end, they got it together and Tim League from Alamo came in and off it went. But the timing was right, well, because, you know, the run lasted longer than we thought it would in Britain, and so this was a good time, actually, the autumn.
You know, the first time I watched the movie, I couldn't help but notice there was no media in it, except for that moment where they find Fessel's head in the tree. There's, like, no bumbling reporters. There's, you know, there's no media characters at all. And but then when I watched it again, I realized that, of course, there's media, and it's the media of today. It's YouTube clips. You know, the film starts off with Waj, you know, making his little YouTube video. But kind of wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on this user-generated video of today. You know, your last project, Nathan Barley, was kind of a takedown on the people who were making this kind of stuff, but it was still pre-YouTube.
It was. We were Charlie and Brooker and I, who, well, he was the he actually invented Nathan Barley as a web page character. We're talking about this the other day, and we couldn't quite believe it. Everything's happened so fast, and we feel like very old men. We were going, did we really do that before YouTube? That really doesn't seem right. But I think that, I mean, there are two interesting points there. The one about the, yeah, I mean, these guys are self-mediating, you know, and it's to some, to the, you know, it is self-glorifying, some of this stuff, some of this jihadi stuff as well. There is a degree of bathing in your own self-image, if you can imagine that from some of the poorly realized videos that you see. But that's the attempt. And I'm pretty sure, I don't think I made this up, that one of the cells that was under surveillance during the research period were saying to each other, we're going to make a mind-blowing documentary about jihad, bro. This will blow the West's mind. And they were sort of filming themselves. And that's why in the film you see, you know, Hassan has got a camera and he's filming them when they arrive at the airport. You know, we never bothered to expand that into a story. It didn't seem interesting enough, didn't have enough room, but that's what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah.
He's basically, this is us, this is our thing, boys. It's like a rock band, you know, documenting a tour. And you can't go anywhere now without somebody popping up with a camera. So why would this be any different? But also, a lot of the research that meant that I had to go to events which were covered by news one way or another anyway. And it did amuse me that my presence there would put the journalists into a paranoid state, because they couldn't imagine any world in which anything else around them was more interesting than they were. So I was bound to be there to be looking at what they were doing, was I? Rather than, say, a big rally with a lot of people saying, kill Tony Blair.
But do you spend a lot of time watching YouTube? It is sort of like the ultimate speak your brains medium, isn't it?
I don't have. I mean, like, I'm just not good enough with my time. I rely on filtering processes. I mean, I do see YouTube, but I only recently caught up with the "Don't Taser Me, Bro" clip, which everyone else, I don't know how many millions that's had. So I'm late on those ones.
Okay, but you know, you have spent a lot of time battling with suits over your work. You know, legendary battles in radio and television. It seems that at a gut level, you must appreciate that in this new media ecology, the suits aren't there. And it seems that you almost took advantage of this by turning to the audience to help raise money for the film at one point in the project.
Well, turning to the... That was a suit dodge, I see. No, not quite. It was an accident, really. I think it would be a really hard thing to do. People get very excited about this kind of new model. You know, you can raise money by, you know, taking a small amount off a lot of people. But that came up by accident because a gossip column mentioned that we were having difficulty raising the money. And then people got in touch with that column and said, we'd like to give money. And they got in touch with us. And so it caused it. But we didn't have to press collect on that because... somebody came in at the last minute, and that was a better deal, I think, because we were the model that we would have to set up would be that you give money but you don't get anything back. And I figured that the people who were kindest enough to offer that money they'd probably end up going to the film and paying for it anyway. So, you know, you don't want to punish people. It's like, you know, when I remember, you know, Prince basically can always rely on some people paying an absolutely exorbitant price for a ticket, no matter how bad his last recording's been. And you sometimes see that. And I think if people are sort of loyal enough to want to say, have something for nothing, it's quite nice to be able to say, well, actually, the thanks, but we don't need to take the money. Because actually what they did was they encouraged us at a point where we'd sort of ground to a halt. So we basically thought, if this many people are interested, it really gives you a fillip to keep going.
So you mentioned all these reporters at some of the rallies and events you would go to that you were covering when you were doing research for the film, but yet they're not in the film. Was that a conscious decision to sort of keep them out?
They're not really part of it. I mean, you know, I guess Geraldo pretending that he's under gunfire and ducking things which aren't there maybe is quite funny. I mean, there are funny bits in the coverage, but they're not really part of the real story. Until we've had a documentary maker sort of getting embedded with a cell and ending up being the first one to run into the market square and blow himself to pieces. Could happen. It hasn't happened yet.
You know, there's this great quote I found that you said that a lot of the positive reception to the day-to-day and on the hour, your fake news shows, had a lot to do with the way its existence confirmed to reporters that they were as important as they had always believed themselves to be?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, you know, that thing I mentioned, I saw a man up a news ladder looking preposterous in a crowd of people at a demonstration, and I happened to know from his colleagues that he went back saying, I'm stuffed, he's gonna rip me up. But, there's a self-regard in that, as there is in most things, but it's sort of, you know, you kind of do something like that, and you sense you're ripping a bit at the fabric, and then journalists come up to you and say, when are you going to do this again? That was hilarious. That was great. Because it's always the person who's sitting next to them that's really the target.
You know, I don't think I can go a week without hearing something on the news, and not just the BBC, and thinking, like, oh my God, this is like straight out of Brass Eye or straight out of the day-to-day. And, you know, when I knew I was going to get to meet you, I started a list, but I had to throw it away because it was just too awful. I mean, it seems like they've just learned nothing.
Yeah, but why are they in the business of learning? I mean, I just think, you know, you're in the business of basically being a loudmouth in a social gathering. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have high volume, and you're going to have to keep distracting people with high-intensity gossip, aren't you? And probably quite a lot of fibs.
But you know what seems even more absurd is this sort of fake news industry that you gave birth to here in the USA. You know, we have The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, which are actually institutions. They're like, they've become media institutions. And, you know, you mentioned Charlie Booker earlier with Newswipe. And then, you know, there's no Sacha Baron Cohen without what you started. Did you have, it seems to me, though, that I've always suspected that you knew early on that if you wanted to, you could have kept doing that sort of thing over and over again forever?
Only if I was pretty brain damaged, I think. I mean,
you didn't want to, it seems.
I think, look, from a personal point, I can't speak for anyone else. From a personal point of view, you just do things when they interest you, and then you don't carry on doing them when they don't interest you. Because even if you've been in that position a bit, you know how bad it feels. And actually, it doesn't really, it doesn't really work, does it? You'd rather, I was about to say, you'd rather Bob Dylan made a Christmas album than repeated himself. However,
having heard the Bob Dylan Christmas record,
that may be the opposite of the rule that describes the condition. You need an anti-rule, don't you?
Yes,
you
have yes.
So whatever the opposite of that rule I've just said about Bob Dylan is the true rule by which I would operate.
Well, let's talk about film for a second. You know, making this film, you're now a king of all media, except you're not
what?
On Twitter. You're not on Twitter.
No. No, the king of all media, that was a crown fashioned and made and worn pretty well by someone here, so...
Yeah, but you've done radio, you've done television, now you've done film, and if you add in Twitter, I think that would...
I'm an intruder. I'm a stalker in all media, or perhaps a squatter in all media. I'm not going to take up a squat in Twitter anytime soon. I mean, you know, I don't have the need to sort of use it as a droopy marketing tool, or I don't have a pathological... personality disorder. Yeah. So why would I get involved in Twitter? And basically, it's a route to madness. It's great fun to watch happen and pick up bits of, but I think compulsive Twitterers are the closest to people who actually advertise themselves as psychopaths.
What about film? Is this a medium you want to do more of now that you've done one?
I'd do another film if the right idea sauntered in.
Now, I'd love to talk to you about radio for a second. You started your career in radio, but even after the success of The Day Today, you came back to it with Blue Jam. It seems like this was a medium that really worked well for you.
Well, I really enjoyed it. And Blue Jam felt like a noise, so radio was the obvious place for it. I mean, it really did feel like a sort of misty noise. So
it just seems like a medium that was really works well for someone like you with the wanting to carve out this space to do things on your own terms.
Well, people
always
talk about media as kind of sort of types of flower bed or opportunities, kind of little shapes of window through which to hurl your projectiles. But I think they're sort of textures, not delivery systems, even though they are, of course, but you don't sort of feel your way into a delivery system. You can feel something as a texture. So it's not like, this gives you opportunity to do this, or this amount of reach, or this is how people consume this these days. You know, my brain doesn't work that way. But I do enjoy, you know, I do enjoy the process of radio. And even when I'm sort of having to edit, like, the sound for a trail or something, anything that, you know, I've got Pro Tools shunting around or whatever, there's a kind of an allure to that. Dubbing the film, I get really stuck into dubbing the film because... it's sort of, I don't know, it's just not going to go, it's not going to go away. It's not going to go out of my head. This noise in my ears is not going to leave.
It's still at the sort of the bottom of the food chain when it comes to media flower bed. You know, you have radio at the bottom and it's sort of looked down upon.
Yeah, why look at it as a hierarchy? I mean, it honestly isn't. I mean, it is if you see that the media is a career ladder.
Well, it's treated it that way. I mean...
Yeah, but I think that's an advantage too, because it means that you can quietly get on with things mm-hmm. without people worrying. I mean, yeah, you know, if you... clearly you are status obsessed, and therefore if you wear your radio badge you'll be, you know, at the back of the party with no one paying any interest. But, you know, maybe that's the best place to be sometimes.
I think that, you know, WFMU is a station that kind of
wears your badge proudly.
Absolutely. And maybe I'm just making too much of it, romanticizing it, but, you know, is this a medium that you think one day of returning to? Or
I mean, I think of it frequently, but I suppose I do hound myself with the idea that it would, you know, the idea has to be right. But I think that's possibly an evasion strategy. I mean, maybe I should just get stuck in and do it, you know. But it's sort of, you know, you do have to have the impetus to want to do it. What does that mean? It means you do have to want to do it. You can't sort of walk into a radio studio. I mean, my anxiety nightmares are not sitting an exam and not knowing what to write. They're sitting in a radio studio and not knowing what to say. So you don't want to actually
make
that
nightmare.
Come alive. It's a completely, you know,
we
right?
Have,
so,
of
I mean, it's quite a good, really basic. It shows I've got a very basic, simple functioning brain that roughly understands predicaments in a simple binary way.
You know, when you see the whole cell together in the car, driving around, singing, or just kind of screwing up or goofing off, you're reminded that this is a cell of idiots. And it seems, you know, going through your work, whether it be celebrities on Brass Eye or the media makers and Nathan Barley, to these guys, you are kind of always been concerned with idiots.
You call them idiots. I call them human beings. I think that isn't it? It's at least we were born as a joke, and the fact that we think we're clever doesn't get away from the fact that we probably are mainly idiots, right? I mean, anybody who achieves anything great has a moment of where their idiocy breaks down and something else pops through. And I think, what are you suggesting, that this is a film where I've learned to love the idiot?
No, I'm just wondering if there's something about the nature of this medium.
I mean, maybe that's true, actually. You know, maybe that's true.
I kind of want to end it on that. I like that.
Learn to love the idiot.
Yeah. Thank you so much for spending a whole freaking hour with us.
It didn't seem that long. It seemed all of 49 minutes.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Reducing the Size of the Question, a conversation with Chris Morris. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. You can find links and pictures on the playlist page and subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, For the Record, with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 748, update on the revision of the history of World War II. This program is being recorded on July 17th of the year 2011. In this program, we're going to be once again revisiting the rewriting of history. And that is something that really is quite common. And I think that a rewriting, or at the very least a reinterpretation of history, is fundamental to the imposition of totalitarian governments of any stripe. And in particular, with regard to the Second World War, there has been a steady erosion of the edifice of fact, historical fact, so to speak, and substituting itself, or being substituted for that historical fact, is ideologized revisionist thinking. One of the things that makes it easy for the history of the Second World War to be revised is the fact that most people just don't know very much about it to begin with, aside from the fact that there are many historical, international, and ethnic global complexities that are simply unknown to not only Americans, but a great many people. For example, we're going to be talking in this program about the Baltic states, Estonia in particular. We're going to be talking about Croatia down in the Balkans and the Ustashi. We're going to be talking about the Vlaamsbach and also the Walloons in Belgium. And these are simply names that are unknown and political and ethnic groups that are unknown to most people, Americans in particular. And so revising the history of World War II in such a way as to change the way these particular elements fit into the overall historical mosaic of World War II and fascism is a relatively easy thing to do. With regard to Americans, I'm reminded of Ambrose Bierce's observation that, quote, "War is God's way of teaching Americans geography." Perhaps. I don't know if even God could teach Americans about history, and indeed, an awful lot of people seem to be either willing to forget it or else too tired or too otherwise distracted or occupied to stand against or to repudiate the revision of the history of World War II. Of course, another thing that makes fascism and the history of World War II, which was initiated by that political phenomenon, an easy thing to revise, is that the history itself is fundamentally wrong, at least as far as it's told in this country. In this country, we are told that fascism was an aberration, that it was a bunch of nasty, crazy people hypnotizing everybody and making them all go crazy. But then along came the Allies, and that took care of everything, or it would have, but along came Joseph Stalin, and he hypnotized everybody and made them go crazy, and finally that all ended as well. In fact, fascism, or corporatism, as Benito Mussolini termed it, and he was the originator or the imprimatur of the system, the corporate state was something that was viewed with great favor by many of the dominant political and financial and industrial elements in this country and their associated political forces. Indeed, some of the most powerful industrialists and financiers around the world, and also some of the most powerful religious entities as well, such as the Vatican and other elements of religious ideology, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, were allied with and supported fascism and were inextricably linked with its history of aggression. So the fact that many of the most prestigious and powerful people in our society, in Western society, supported fascism, supported corporatism, liked the idea of the corporate state, and saw to it not only that some of the same fascist elements were put back in power in places like Germany, Italy, Japan, and elsewhere, but also they saw to it that some of the top Nazi and Japanese killers were put to work for the U.S. national security establishment under a number of programs that were kept hidden from the American people at the end of World War II. Nonetheless, those programs have borne an unsavory fruit, and much of the bloodshed that has taken place in the decades following World War II is directly attributable to the failure to accurately and actively oppose fascism and to cleanse it from the global situation. It should really not come as a great surprise to us to see the history of World War II being revised. Brave listeners, hardy listeners, enterprising listeners are encouraged to access AFA program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. That was even before I began talking about the Borman Group, the Borman Capital Network, on the air. But that will give people a long introduction, a long acquaintance with really how the United States lost the Second World War. We didn't lose it on the battlefield, obviously, but we lost it economically and politically. And I am afraid that what we're seeing right now with the budget debate in the midsummer of 2011 essentially represents a fulfillment, or at least a potential fulfillment, of the 1934 coup attempt in which many of this country's high rollers attempted to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Many of these same industrialists and financiers were ardent supporters of Hitler and Mussolini. They sought to replace Roosevelt with a fascist dictatorship here in the United States. And the fact that fascism has been fundamentally misrepresented and as a result misunderstood, and as a result fascism has, and the forces that engendered it have in many ways been perpetuated either as a viable or perceived viable ideology, and or as something, an agenda that many of the most powerful elements in this society see as something desirable, something to be fulfilled. So it really should not surprise us to see the history of fascism and World War II being consciously revised. I mentioned that one of the things that makes that possible in many places is the fact that the facts are simply not familiar to the average American and an awful lot of other people. In the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, fascism came in the form of